published in October. So today, I'm going to do the journal club with our pulmonary pathology fellow at the University of Michigan, who is in the Zoom with us already. So we are going to present four articles in detail, including two neoplastic papers and two non-neoplastic papers. So I would like now to start. Now you are muted.
Yes. How I can share my screen? I'm sorry. It's not.
Oh.
I think only meeting organizer and presenter can share it. I need.
I couldn't.
There should be the share button by the leave button. The leave button on your extreme right. There's a share button.
It's in my screen?
It should be on your screen.
Yeah, there is, but it's like gray. It's not in the color.
Yeah, exactly. Same thing true for me. I couldn't share.
Oh,
oh
okay,
my.
So,
that's a setup problem. I don't know how to set it up, how to change that. Does anyone know? Because I'm probably the one they did the calendar invite.
I think you can change. If you hit that, I think maybe if you right click on it, it'll allow you to share who can share, you know?
No, it doesn't do anything with the right
really?
Click.
Well, it's weird, Anya, because some of us could actually share, so I don't think it's related.
Yeah, because I can share. Mine is okay to share as well.
So it says only meeting organizers and presenters can share. I guess we are probably not part of the organizer. That's why we don't have the privilege to share. That's a bummer.
Yeah, mine's grayed out, too. I couldn't share if I wanted
maybe it's
to.
Maybe it's a Michigan thing. I mean, I'm just saying, because all the Mayo people can.
Yeah.
Margaret Kelly, can you share?
Oh, I'll try.
So how should we do it? Should we just do it without sharing it, or?
I'm on my cell phone because we're driving to.
Oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
Okay,
no,
let's try again. Can you try now?
Oh wait, I can. Yeah, I
yes.
can. Mine,
I changed the setting.
Yeah,
here.
I
found it.
Yeah, that fixed
it.
How did you do it, Anya?
I see it.
It's under controls. There is a control button on top. And under control, you can click on things.
Oh.
Do you see my screen? I'm
yes.
now sharing my PowerPoint slide.
Yes.
Oh, good.
Thank you. So, can I start? Yes, please, now.
Okay, so this is the article that I'm going to present today. This is the differentiated solitary fibrous tumor. So this entity was first reported in 2009, and then since then, there were a few articles investigating about this entity, but they are still under-recognized due to its rarity. So this journal is from the Mass General Brigham, and they investigated 25 cohort cases to see the clinical pathologic and molecular features and trying to characterize the morphologic spectrum and apply next generation sequencing to investigate fusion variants and as well as a secondary gene alteration. And then they also do the comprehensive literature review. So moving on to the result, this is the table one for the 25 cases from their cohort. It's between 2010 to 2023. And there are 13 males and 12 females, and the median age is 63 years old. And 21 cases, which is 84%, were primary tumors, here in primary, and then mostly from the pelvic and thoracic cavity. 3 cases are the metastasis case, and then 1 case is a local recurrence in the thoracic cavity. All resected specimens and all cases had areas of conventional solitary fibrous tumor component, and then which are either present concurrently or in the prior specimen. Morphology, the differentiated component showed abrupt transition from the conventional component, and then they have a pleomorphic pattern or bizarre spindle, it's the spindle pier, the pleomorphic spindle. This is the round cell or the epithelioid cell patterns. And 4 cases has a heterologous component. in 9 of 20 cases are classified as a high risk using the three variable model. And then also they follow up what's going on after that, live or death. And this is a table from the comprehensive literature review. Most cases are a primary tumor. And then anatomic site are the pelvic cavity, 20%, retro peritoneum, 80%, trunk in 60%, and thoracic cavity are the 14%. And most the differentiated component have a pleomorphic feature like their cohort study. And the heterologous component are the reported in 30% of the cases. Interestingly, one have a neuroendocrine component. So this is the picture from the representative figure of the differentiated solitary fibrous tumor from the cohort study. So A, this is a kidney specimen with the spindle morphology, pleomorphic spindle morphology. And then B is from the lung tissue, having, again, pleomorphic cells with a vesicular nuclei, prominent nucleoli. This C is from the round cell pattern. This is from the pelvic area. And then D, this is from the thigh mass with the epithelioid pattern. They describe pseudopapillary growth pattern. This one is from the heterologous element. A, this is a pelvic specimen having osseous differentiation. B, this is from the supine with the chondroid differentiation. C is from the pelvis, again, from the lipoblastic differentiation. D is a supine, again, having an abrupt squamous differentiation. This is the immunostaining to show STAT6 and P53 and RB. And this is from the conventional solitary fibrous tumor area with the nicely positive STAT6 staining. And then B, this is from a de-differentiated SFD area with a loss or weak STAT6 staining. And then C, this is the P53 with the mutated and the no expression in the de-differentiated area. And then this is the RB, loss of RB expression in the de-differentiated area. So this is the summary of the IHC and the molecular study from their cohort study. So CD34 is positive in 90% of cases, conventional component, and then 12 cases, which is 60% of cases, showed the differentiated component showed loss of expression of CD34. This is a STAT6, and all cases which is available for the STAT6 immunostaining show positive in all conventional area. But in the differentiated area, 8 cases, which is 36%, show completely loss of expression. And then 2 cases, which is 9%, show reduced expression. Like this. This tendency is similar to the comprehensive literature review. It's not in the table, but they said that STAT6 was expressed in 100% on the conventional component, but lost in 12%, reduced in 23% in the differentiated component. And they do the molecular study, targeted DNA sequencing, and from the paraffin embedded tissue, which is only from the differentiated component area, from the 14 cases, which is from here to here. And this is the table, a figure from that 14 cases. So about half of the differentiated component lost CD34. This blue means the lost. And then STAT6 lost. And P53, 5 cases, this orange are mutated, which is along with this genetic alteration. And 5 cases of RB, loss of RB in IHC, which is also matched to the genetic alteration in these 3 cases. They're talking about the fusion breakpoint in NAV2 STAT6. They have a variable breakpoint, actually, but they can make a 2 major, they can group to the 2 major variant, which is shown in this schematic diagram. So there is mainly 2 group, which is STAT6-4 and STAT6-TAD. The full means that the fusion retain full length of the transcript. And then STAT6TAD means that having only this transactivation domain. And this is from their case, cohort case. This is from the comprehensive review cases. And then mostly they say that most cases has this STAT6TAD group. This is from the cohort, and here this area is from the STAT6 in the cohort study. And they do the statistic analysis about in terms of any like a disease survival. They are looking for any relationship with the disease survival with this STAT6 variant, but there is no difference in disease survival between STAT6-4 and STAT6-TAD variant. This is the figure to show that in the survival analysis with the immunohistochemistry and the molecular analysis. And then CD34 does not have any relation, but STAT6, P53, TART-T promoter mutation status, they are associated with the shorter survival, which means that if there is a loss of STAT6 in the differentiated area, that means there is some shorter survival. And this suggests the contribution of a genomic instability to the aggressive behavior of this tumor. This is the final result from them. So they do the multivariable regression analysis for STAT6 loss in the differentiated area. And then they find that STAT6 loss in the differentiated area is the only independent predictor for shorter disease survival, which has a p0.023. So this is all from the result. And then there's a couple discussion in the article. They are saying, they're talking about the differential diagnosis of the differentiated solitary fibrous tumor, which include the differentiated liposarcoma based on morphology. And also this differentiated liposarc can have a STAT6 in 10%. 10% differentiated liposarc can have a STAT6. So this may be mimicking, this might be mimicker for the differentiated solitary fibrous tumor in terms of morphology and then IHC. And also carcinoma, because the differentiated solitary fibrous tumor can have an epithelial differentiation, so carcinoma can be a differential. So identification of a conventional component is very helpful for the accurate diagnosis. Also, they're talking about the STAT6 loss in the differentiated component, even though the presence on the gene fusion. Gene fusion is present, but the loss of expression. So they don't study about that, but they mentioned but the possibility of a post-translational regulation. Also, there's some limitation talking about in the journal. They say that many cases are the consult cases, so there is a limited slide and blocks of information. And then they didn't do any comparison of molecular study between conventional component and differentiated component. So they said this is the limitation. The take-home message from this article is STAT6 can be lost in the differentiated area. So negative expression of it cannot rule out solitary fibrous tumor. So careful research for the conventional area and also molecular analysis may require for the accurate diagnosis. And then loss of STAT6 represent an independent prognostic factor associated with the shorter disease survival, so may serve as a surrogate marker for genomic instability that contributes to the aggressive behavior of this tumor. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Nao. Do we have any questions from the group?
Nice presentation. A question. I was surprised you showed the D'Amico prognostic score. You know, we've been so we've had several of these lately, including one that had a beautiful angiosarcoma. I think the case was Max's. And we've been classifying these as sarcomas and using a sarcoma template for these rather than the recurrence score. And I don't remember, so I don't know if Brandon's on, but he was the one who said, you know, that's really the one we should use for that setting. So I don't know what other people have been doing with these?
Great question. I don't think I have ever come across a case like that, but I just feel like this is a good paper we need to be aware of. I mean, I also quite surprised about that the D'Amico risk score is only 1.24 for these cases. So it doesn't seem to be a good scoring system in these contexts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why we've been doing the sarcoma template for these and using, you know, that approach and saying these are different beasts than the ordinary SFT.
That makes sense to me, Henry.
Sorry, Christine, I
was just saying that makes sense in this setting of a de-differentiated to me, kind of their approach.
Any other questions?
Yeah, so I was wondering, great presentation. Thanks for choosing this article. Let's say you have a biopsy and you only have the de-differentiated part on it, if it's taking over a large area of the tumor. Is there any hint that could suggest that this could be a de-differentiated solitary fibrous tumor and you actually should probably do NGS to at least see the diffusion if the STAT6 expression is lost?
I think great question. I think you can try STAT6 in the right context. If that positive, that probably solve your problem. If not, I think NGS has to be the answer for in that context for immunobiopsies, my opinion.
So there's nothing on morphology, right? And the CD34 may not help either, because that's lost too, right?
Mm-hmm. So in the differentiated area, the CD34 is often lost.
I can imagine a scenario where you're just going to get it wrong. Because, if you have a biopsy of the carcinoma part, how in the world are you going to deduce that there's an SFT there, right? I mean, especially thinking about the lung. I mean, you know, if this shows up in another site, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, most of these were not thoracic, but there's no way you're going to get to that diagnosis on a needle biopsy.
Right, right. Totally.
Probably the most thing is treatment, right? Like, how would you treat these patients? Like, are you going to treat them as an SFT or are you going to treat them as a sarcoma? So I think as long as they're getting the right, you know, chemo, surgery, et cetera, I'm probably okay, even if you do, I guess, miss the differentiated component.
Yeah, and it sounds like it has to go into our differential diagnosis now of all high-grade sarcomas that we get in the lung now. So you have to think about it now.
Yep.
And it might be STAT6 negative.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the message from this paper. Okay, I think we better move on. Thank you now so much for your next presentation of this
Thank
article.
You.
So I'm going to share my screen. Can you see my paper? Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So the next paper that I am going to present is a paper on mesothelioma, which is this paper from an Italian group. So this paper basically is to examine whether MTAP on IHC is a good surrogate marker to predict homozygous deletions of CDKN2A on FISH. We know there's a pretty good correlation when the study, to examine whether there's good correlation in peritoneal mesothelioma. I think we do know in the past studies, many studies showing that there's a fairly good correlation between MTAP loss by IHC correlating with underlying CDKN2A homozygous deletion with both good sensitivity and specificity. So initially, I just thought, oh, the same concept can apply to peritoneal mesothelioma, but this paper actually explored in this area saying, apply the concept from the core mesothelioma might not apply to peritoneal mesothelioma. So as we all know that MTAP, as we know that CDKN2A homozygous deletion seen more commonly in core mesothelioma, but less so commonly in the peritoneal mesothelioma. Before I thought that probably is because the sarcomatoid and the biphasic mesothelioma phenotype is less common in the peritoneal cavity, and CDKN22A homozygous deletion is more correlated with the sarcomatoid morphology. And I thought that probably is why we see less frequent this kind of a loss of homozygous of CDKN2A. So in here, in these papers, basically, if we go to their method, so in here, they start with a selection of cases of 50 cases from their cohort. And in these 50 cases, it includes a significant amount of biphasic needs, or which is 19 cases, 38% of their cohort, and 8% of the cohort is a comatose needs, or and predominantly is abscisal mesothelioma. So the first step they did is to do a FISH analysis on all these 50 cases. And some of the cases, they feel like it didn't pass their quality control for the FISH results. So we remove a few cases. So in the end, they only end up with 39 cases. And in the 39 cases, there are still majority is abscisal mesothelioma composed of 61.5% of the whole cohort, but there's also significant amount of biphasic needs of 30%, and with less than 1% of sarcomatoid needs. So in here, then with these 39 cases, they apply the immunostain of MTAP to all these 39 cases. And the antibody clone they use is this particular one. I don't know which clone you use in your lab, but in our lab, we're using a different clone, it's 42-T. But there was a study from this paper analyzing various antibody clones of MTAP. And in this paper, you can see the 2G4, which is used in this paper, is pretty popular antibody used by other labs too. And the University of Chicago and our lab, we are using this particular clone. So just keep that in mind, the clone they use is this particular clone, might not be the same clone as what you use in your lab. So then they analyze, so of course we know complete loss of MTAP, we can say it's an aberrant expression, right? It's complete loss. But in this paper, they also talk about a faint cytoplasmic positivity defined as weaker than internal positive control. So they regard this also as a positive result with no expression of MTAP. So I didn't know about this criteria. In practice, I don't think I use the faint cytoplasmic staining less than internal control as a positive result for MTAP. Then they use the two cutoff. One cutoff is completely lost, one cutoff. They also use another cutoff, is 30% of cells staining with less than 30% of cells staining with MTAP, also regarded as a positive result. So I think this is, which is also something I was not aware of, that using less than 30% of the cells staining with MTAP as a positive result. I think this is coming from this paper. And in this paper, they're proposing that if you using the 30% cutoff for MTAP as the reading, it gives you the best sensitivity and the specificity here. That's why I think they also propose using the 30% as a cutoff. So they use the both cutoff, and you can see when they use the like the 1% or complete loss as the criteria to call a positive result from MTAP, it shows fairly good specificity, but really low sensitivity. When they use the 30% cutoff, even though the sensitivity is improved, but still not great sensitivity, the specificity is sacrificed. And then when they use the ROC analysis, they basically could say that the MTAP IC has very limited predictive value to predict underlying CDKN2A homozygous lesion. So meaning in this site, it cannot faithfully the loss of MTAP cannot faithfully predict the underlying homozygous lesion of CDKN2A. So a few comments for their staining. I feel like some of their picture that they provided, the internal control didn't show really robust internal control in comparison to the staining patterns that we used to see in our lab. So I guess using a different platform, a different antibody, maybe we'll have different results. And another thing, I think also they talk about some kind of like a heterogeneous staining pattern, like especially when they use the 30%, right, subclonal loss of MTAP. But when they do the fish study, they didn't specify how exactly they did the fish study, whether the fish study was read in different areas, like in areas with MTAP expression and in areas without MTAP expression, how they look like on fish study. This kind of details was not mentioned in the paper. So I was wondering whether this part could contribute to the discrepancy between the MTAP loss and IC and the fish result. So basically, I think the conclusion for this paper, just be cautious when you use MTAP. IC alone, they have a poor predictive value in predicting underlying CDKN2A homozygous mutation. That's all for this paper. Any questions for this one? If not, I think we can move on to the next paper. The next paper is non-neoplastic. So this paper, the first one I want to present is about this standardization clinical terms for interstitial lung disease. So this one, I think in the recent months is kind of like a hot topic. So this paper, I think is a followed up on this particular paper about updated classification of interstitial pneumonia. But unfortunately, I think this paper hasn't been published in print. That's why this paper hasn't been discussed in our journal club in detail, but I will just briefly give you some background on this paper, because the current paper we're going to discuss is kind of like related to this paper. So you can see in this statement, in the committee, there's a few pathologies which I highlighted here. So in here, and also you can see basically, I want to show. Basically, I want to show you the major interstitial pneumonia patterns from this statement. So basically, that's what they proposed for the interstitial pneumonia major categories. So I think most of them are similar to before. The major changes are this bronchiolar centric interstitial pneumonia, or BIP category, and HP is removed as a category, and also the DAD. And another one is that DIP is removed and replaced with alveolar macrophage pneumonia, as shown in here. So this is the proposed major interstitial pneumonia classification as an update from the prior edition. And in this paper that we're going to discuss, basically it focuses on the standard clinical terms of interstitial lung disease diagnosis. So in here, basically, how they perform the study is basically summarized in this figure one. So basically, they have 10 committees. Oh, also, I just want to show you. So this is the pathologists are participating in this study. Total, there are 6 pathologists to participate in the study. And this study is conducted in this way. So basically, they have doctors Ryerson and John Holson. These two doctors, they do a one-on-one interview with 10 experts in different areas. And this is the 10 experts for the initial one-on-one interview. And in these 10 experts, they include 3 pulmonary pathologists. So these 10 experts, basically, they decide on what are the terms they need people to vote on. So they identified 60 distinct terms with 2 root terms. The 2 root terms is ILD and interstitial pneumonia, which everybody agree on, so no need to vote on. And there's also 8 terms that have no alternative for terms suggested by the expert or by the literature. So those 8 terms do not need to be voted on either. So in the end, they have 50 terms with more than 1 name suggested or used in the clinical practice. Then they refine the 50 terms. They write down the reason why they want to propose the preferred terms. Then they gave these 50 terms in an online version to give all the full committee to vote on these terms. So the full committee, they say include 29 committee members, but I think probably 30. I think maybe some one pathologist. I counted six, but they only mentioned five in their text. So this is a 29 full committee members. They vote on these 50 terms. Then they give their a reading on these 50 terms with strong agree. Give a rate of 5 and strong disagree, give a rate of 1. Then if the median score is more than 4 with an interquartile range less than 1, agreement is achieved. So in the first round of sending this survey to the 29 committee members, 47 of the terms achieved the full agreement with 3 terms without full agreement. The 3 terms including alveolar, microfast pneumonia, idiopathic PAD, and radiotherapy associated lung injury. Then a second round of voting said then in the second round, these 3 terms also achieved full agreement. So that's basically how they performed the study, and they summarized the all these terms in 10 tables that you can go into with more details. I think more relevant to us is like in this interstitial pneumonia table. I think most because this is a new term, idiopathic bronchiolar dendritic interstitial pneumonia. Basically, it replaces HP for patients in which there's no known no antigen identified. So I think this is, to me, is really hard to take, because I feel like this is immediately contradictory to the recently published HP guideline, which is causing a lot of confusion to me. Because I mean, based on the guideline published for HP, which is not too long ago, look like we can make a pretty decent confident diagnosis on HP even without known antigen exposure if you have the right clinical context and the BL showing lymphocytosis and good histology. Even without knowing the antigen exposure, you can make a pretty confident diagnosis on HP. So changing the term to this one, I think it's less meaningful, it's more descriptive. And a lot of time, I think words that matter. I think that makes the clinician have less there to search more vigorously over antigen exposure to cause patients disease, in which the antigen avoidance is a main thing of treatment. So to me, I personally don't like this change. This one, I think idiopathic DAD replacing acute interstitial pneumonia, this is one change for us. Some terms I think I learned from this is including the following interstitial lung abnormality, meaning abnormal interstitial CT findings below the threshold for ILD. I also learned the progressive pulmonary fibrosis, need progression in at least 2 domains in clinical, physiologic, and radiologic, and usually excluding IPS. I used to like to say hypersensitivity pneumonia, but now the preferred term should be hypersensitivity pneumonitis. So basically, I think this is a good paper to keep because this is the consensus, the clinical term by incorporating the recently newly updated interstitial pneumonia classification. I think we probably will have more discussion in the future when the real paper published in print. But just for this one, any questions?
I asked them why they didn't include smoking-related interstitial fibrosis. Well, I asked Kerry, and she said, oh, we couldn't put everything in. Because I'd like to know what I'd like that to be standardized to a certain name, because Katzenstein calls it SRIF and Andrew Cho calls it something else, and it wasn't in there. I couldn't see it.
For smoking. Yeah. So right now,
you see it all the time when we get lung resections, right? We see it all the time.
I think this is, must be a topic continue to be discussed, because I think, like for example, BIP is just a provisional term, still subject to more studies, because I think for this classification, some really prominent members who used to be in the committee for this new classification, but they left because the fundamental disagreement with this new discussion, this new classification, as you can see in this. Four prominent members, they left the committee while this new constitution was finalized. So they must have a disagreement with this final classification. And I think BIP still remain as a provisional entity. So I didn't answer your question about the smoking related.
Yeah, it wasn't a question. I was just saying they didn't include it in this paper. They ignored it. They left it out.
Okay. The last one I think I want to present is a paper from our male clinical group at Arizona. I think the whole group is in the authors, and also Dr. Andrew Church is an author in this paper. I think this paper is a really good review paper giving guidelines about how to analyze transbronchial choir biopsy to make a diagnosis for diffuse parenchymal lung disease. Even though it's a review paper, I like to present it because my knowledge in this area is very limited. Our pulmonologists haven't used choir biopsy to address the question of diffuse lung disease. My experience of choir biopsy to answer diffuse lung disease mainly from consultation practice. So in here, in the introduction, in this review paper, it mentioned about that the study in this area is very limited. There are only 5 reports comparing a choir biopsy to vets surgical lung biopsy. And only one of these 5 reports actually proposes a diagnostic criteria for UIP, and I think this is referred to this paper, the CODIS paper, in which Dr. Meyer is one of the pathologists in this paper. So in this paper, they propose that patchy fibrosis, fibroblast foci, and the absence of alternative diagnosis, those are the 3 main features. The combined of these features can predict a good a diagnosis UIP in the paired surgical lung biopsy with a pretty high odds ratio to 23.4. And this paper also mentioned that there's also recent work mainly from Dr. Church, and I think Dr. Henry Kessler is also part of the authorship on additional cryo biopsies for UIP, fibrotic HP and CTD, ILD. But in here, these 2 papers, these 2 papers from Dr. Jerb and Dr. Tedler, this paper, I think their ground truth is on MPD diagnosis. Then extract the data from this MPD agreed upon diagnosis to attract the physiological features for different categories. Whereas in this CODEX paper, the ground truth is surgical lung biopsy. So this is a background. So in here, incredibly, these authors may have experience of reviewing prior biopsy of like over 1,000 cases. So their data also coming from 2 publications, which I mentioned from Dr. Church and Dr. Tezler. And they also included a report from the CODEX study. So this is their main resources to generate the guideline regarding how to analyze a choir biopsy. So Lee proposed a stepwise manner to address diffuse lung valves, diffuse lung disease using fire valves. So basically, the first step, we need to look for some specific features. If you have a sarcoid or lymphangioma mitosis or LCH, right away you can make a very specific biopsy on fire valve. If you don't have these specific features, then you look for whether there is a global architectural features like fibrosis, honeycomb, architectural distortion. So in the camp of potential chronic interstitial pneumonia, then the next step is looking for fibroblast foci. If you do have fibroblast foci, you can also look for patchy fibrosis or architectural distortion or honeycomb. If you have fibroblast foci plus one of this, you can make a diagnosis of like a UIP on histology, and this the clinical diagnosis could be UIP-IPF or fibrotic HP or CTE-ILD with UIP pattern on histology. If you don't have the fibroblast foci, then you start to look for other patterns to see whether there's an NFIP or NFIP plus OP overlap pattern, and giving a diagnosis of fibrotic HP or CTE-ILD, depending on the clinical context. If you don't have the fibrotic foci, but you do have patchy fibrosis and architectural distortion or honeycomb changing, they suggest to do deeper sections. We mentioned sometimes you can do up to 12 deepers to look for fibroblast foci. If it's present, then you can also, if not present, then you can only offer descriptive diagnosis. So I was wondering if at this point, can we commit this is chronic interstitial pneumonia instead of just very descriptive diagnosis? I wonder whether we can say either cellular or fibrotic chronic interstitial pneumonia. After we already know architectural there's abnormality there. So making it different from here, totally non-diagnostic term. So that's one of my questions for this. And then showing really nice pictures, for example, in here showing like choir biopsy showing sarcoidosis via lymphangitic distribution of the non-hypothetic granuloma. Another picture showing aspiration with aspirated organic particulate showing here associated with the granuloma. A nice picture of the UIP in here. So in here, I think interesting, this is a picture for HP, cellular phase of HP and more fibrotic HP. So in here, I just have a slight comment on this. So they, by looking at the picture of B alone, this is image represents the UIP pattern. But I think based on the Codex paper, I think I probably won't say UIP pattern, even though you have some UIP features, but I think there's also a lot of airway centered abnormality, meaning this is there are some alternative diagnosis could enter with this picture. So I probably will say less UIP on my diagnosis with this picture. And this one showing OP and NSIP overlap features. So I guess I have a question to the group. When you see organized pneumonia on prior biopsy, the interstitial also abnormal as shown in this case, how do you distinguish whether the interstitial changes are secondary changes due to fundamentally organizing pneumonia, or you're truly dealing with NSIP and OP overlap feature? I don't know whether anybody has any comments on that. It's kind of a question that I have already looked at a prior biopsy.
I've got to jump off for another call, but I guess in part I might go back to the imaging, and that may or may not help you. If it's you know, consolidation, peripheral consolidation, like many OP cases, then I'd lean towards OP. But you're right. You in some cases you're not going to be able to separate that out. Depends on the imaging. I would go back to the imaging, which is why MDD is so important in these cryos.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Thanks, I got to hop off. Thanks a lot, appreciate the Journal Club.
Thank you. So I will have a couple of minutes, I mean, almost done. I think sometimes, I think this is also a nice figure to show that sometimes it's hard to tell whether it's organizing pneumonia or subepithelial fibroblast foci. And this paper saying, just thinking about what is accompanying the lesions, if it's coming with organizing pneumonia, even some atypical features, maybe also just mean the whole thing is organizing pneumonia. I just think this is a pretty nice review paper. So to give some guidelines regarding how to analyze fire biopsy, which is truly the trend nowadays to making diagnosis for diffuse lung disease. I personally learned quite a bit from it. I think it's a good read for me. So this is my four papers. This is a review paper, probably. I don't know whether anybody have any comments on this one. Yeah, if not, we're kind of running out of time. And there's some articles for notation. But this article for notation, I didn't read in more detail. So mainly only summaries generated by ChatGPT. I look at it, I think more or less the ballpark is correct. So take a grain of salt when you're reading this notation articles of my summary. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tao.
Thank you.
Thank you.